You can start off now. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Right action. What now is right action? This is very simple, doesn't say very much. But they haven't got much actually in the suttas which says about right action. Refraining from deliberately killing living beings. Refraining from taking what's not given. Refraining from sexual misconduct. Those three. You always have the line. And it's amazing they don't have the alcohol in there. But that is just means you follow wisdom instead of like drugs and alcohol. So refraining from deliberately killing living beings, you abstain from the destruction of life. With a rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious and kindly you dwell compassionate towards all living beings. Refraining from theft, you abstain from taking what is not given. You do not steal the wealth and property of others in the village or in the forest. Refraining from sexual misconduct, you abstain from unlawful, abusive sexual activity. You do not have sexual relationship with those under the age of consent, with those who are unable to give consent, such as mentally disabled, who are not free to refuse consent, such as a student to their teacher, or where such conduct would be breaking the law, or even with one already engaged. So, it's pretty accurate to the meaning of the original, but you know, just change a few things to make it more appropriate to our day and age. So you know that even most countries now, a teacher and a student, the teacher has got sort of some power over the student and can have some coercion. So because of that, you must make sure that student and disciple, student and the teacher do not have any sexual relations. And in fact, just pause there because I don't know why this happens, but there's also some scallywags, monks, who think that, oh no, they can do whatever they want. And certainly in Australia, you know, because of all of the sexual misconduct in many parts of religion, that even I have to have working with children card. So it's law. It is any people who are young, like even today, just in the Dana at Serpentine. Is there any children there? Even if you're not teaching them, you're not alone with them, you have to have the working with children card. Which means you just go to the post office, get your details, get a thing, and just the police do a quick check, and you're fine, and that's it. So, you know, it's very good to have that. We have that in monasteries, and we have sexual abuse policies to make sure that if there is someone, say, who accuses Ajahn Brahm of something, you don't say, oh, it's Ajahn Brahm, it can't be anything. You have to actually investigate and take it seriously. And then, you know, after we say, okay, there was nothing there, but at least it's investigated. Otherwise, yes. Okay, yeah. Well, actually, the rule is panatipata. And atipata means to destroy, to kill. And pana literally means having breath. Bhakas ana pana sati. And it is exactly the same word as the English or the Latin word for breath. You know, the Latin word for breath is animalis, which is where we get animal from. So it's literally anything which has a breath. So you can't really call bacteria, mold, fungus as actually going into that category. So it's only like breathing beings with a respiratory system. So if you're a doctor, if it's, you know, you have some bugs, and if it's either those bugs or me, which one should I do? If the bugs have lost. I mean the little bugs, yeah. What now is right livelihood? Here the noble disciple, having given up wrong livelihood, keeps himself by right livelihood. That doesn't really say very much, does it? That's what it says there. But the lay follower should not engage in these five trades. What five? Trading in weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. Well, I mean, many drugs in the drugstore were poisons. Just like Handaker, you know, you've met him. He's got a couple of drug stores, and he actually he exports drugs into Burma. So he always very, very proud. He says he's a drug runner for the legal ones, like aspirin and paracetamol and stuff like that. But it's really hard to actually say what these really are, because I also had in there in the old days, like being a prison officer. Now, if you work in a prison in the old days, you know, they sometimes torture them and be the hangman. And so that was a really nasty job. But, you know, still in some prisons, people can be quite mean. But there are some prison officers who go there and they really are quite caring. It's wonderful to see that they're really trying to do the best to rehabilitate, you know, those people who have done mistakes in life. So, in the end, what is right livelihood, what is wrong livelihood? What is very certain is for monks. I didn't put it down for monks because most of these are nuns. The wrong livelihood for monks and nuns is doing things like telling lottery numbers, arranging marriages. What else do they do? Sorry? Fortune telling, yes. So all of those sorts of jobs, which monks, some monks unfortunately do, it's just really wrong livelihood. Praying the stock market, investing one game for another, that is just not what the monks are supposed to do. There was one monk in Thailand, and he was the abbot of a monastery, and he just disappeared, vanished one morning. And when they couldn't find him, they checked the accounts, and apparently, because he would count all the money and just keep it for himself, actually, he wasn't keeping it for himself, but he needed more money to build the monastery. So he was on the TV betting on the soccer, on the Premier League. Unfortunately, he was no good. So he lost all the temple money gambling. And of course, that is silly, stupid. That's wrong livelihood. So that's the sort of things which a monk should never get involved in. Right endeavour. Now those are actually the three activities of body and speech and livelihood. So we started from the right view, the non-self, everything's impermanent, let go, be kind, and from that we get the right speech, right action, right livelihood. So also the right endeavour. Why are we practicing these right livelihoods? Where is it aiming to? Right endeavour. And I made a very strong point here, trying to not call it right effort, because it's the effort thing which I've seen in my monk's life causes so much problems for people. So there are these four right endeavors: restraint, abandonment, development, preservation. Most of these is not doing something, saying no to something, letting go. It's not following or forcing, but saying no, restraint, give up, let go, renounce. So the first of the four right endeavours, the endeavour of restraint. And what is the endeavour of restraint? When you see an object, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or feature that generate defilements. Since you left the faculty of sight unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom when seeing. You guard the faculty of sight, and you undertake the restraint of sight. So, for example, when you see that teddy bear there, you see all its colours and you think, oh my goodness, that must be a gay teddy bear. Now that's adding things which is not really there and true, and that might get you wanting or aversion. So you don't... I don't know where that teddy bear came from, it's really cool. But you... When you do, did someone actually die in the washing machine or something? I don't know. I could have never seen that before. So, if you see something, it might be For example, like someone who really hurt you in the past. You know, someone you're afraid of. And you see that, you see its characteristics or feature that generate fear or loathing. So you restrain that. And in fact, actually, you just look at the other part of the person. You may see a snake. But you know, snakes are really cool. Actually, if you touch them, they are very cool. But, you know, they're not really going to harm you. So, if you don't get fear, so you don't get sucked in by any of the characteristics or features that generate defilements. So if you're while watching a movie or you're watching something, you see someone you really like, you know, it's only characteristics, features that generate defilements. If you're looking for someone to like and to love, you go to that part of them which actually fulfills your fantasies. If you really hate somebody, then you look at them and you go to their features which confirm that you're disgust for them. So it's actually you're just choosing characteristics and features that generate defilements. Having heard a sound, a smell, a taste, having felt a bodily feeling, having cognized something in the mind, you do not let yourself get sucked in by any characteristics or features that generate defilements. Since you left the mind faculty unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom with the mind. You guard the mind and you undertake the restraint of the mind. That is called the effort to restrain. So you restrain it so you don't get especially greed, wanting, lust, ill will, aversion. Even if you look at your past, you know, from the objects of the mind, you don't look at that part of the past. Those features, that way of looking at it, which creates ill will, or anger, or guilt. Same with the future, you don't look at those features of the part of the future which generate fear and anxiety. You undertake to restrain that sense of mind with wisdom, so that you look at the future and you don't worry about it. The defilements don't arise. That's the first, the endeavor to restrain, the endeavor to abandon. And what is the endeavor to abandon? Here you do not maintain an arisen motivation of wanting. You abandon it, let it go, renounce it, and bring it to cessation. You do not indulge in an arisen motivation of aversion, an arisen motivation of harming. Those are the three wrong motivations. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. Whenever bad motivations arise, you abandon them, let them go, renounce them, bring them to cessation. This is called the effort to abandon. Now you can see, before you go down, those efforts to abandon, you've been practicing that for a long time. That when you have an arisen motivation of wanting, how do you actually just abandon it, let it go, renounce it, bring it to cessation? If you want to get rid of the wanting, it just gets worse. If you're embarrassed about it, ashamed of it, force it out, it gets worse. That similarly, the anecdote of me thinking sexy thoughts from 3 to 4 p.m. every afternoon. Actually, 3 to 4 p.m. now, isn't it? But that was a long time ago. And that was when I tried to really force them out, and they just got so bad. So these days I teach, practice, you just abandon, you let them go, you renounce them, bring them to cessation with beautiful kindness and wisdom. That is called the endeavor to abandon. When you are mindful of some object, and there arises in you afflicting, unwholesome motivations connected with desire, aversion, and delusion, then, number one, you should give attention to some other object that generates wholesome mind states. Thus, unwholesome states are abandoned and subside. With their disappearance, your mind becomes internally steady, settled, unified, and still. So, what that really means, you know, that you are watching the breath and just, you know, an example. I was meditating many years ago, and this object came into my mind. It was like a nimitta, not a Garfield nimitta, that was really fun. But it was a monster. A demon, like a yakka. Really big eyes, bulging eyes, really scary, red on the outside. And he had teeth. Teeth like vampire teeth. Dripping red stuff. Must have been blood. It had a necklace of skulls. And really spiky hair. It's a long time before the punks. Spiky hair looked really fierce. And its tongue was hanging out. Right in front of me. I love doing that. Especially when there's kids around. It's my monster. And it was right in front of me during meditation. Was I scared? Oh. Give some attention to some other object that generates wholesome states of mind. So I actually looked at that and I decided just to put sunglasses over its bulgy eyes. Because it's a nimitta, it's amazing, you create things. So mental objects are so easy to mess around with. So I put this beautiful, like the old Ray-Ban glasses over this monster. So they look very cool. And then I put its tongue inside, I put a cigarette coming out of its mouth, just like I used to do at school, you know, doodling. And over its hair I put this straw hat with a little flower coming out. And what else did I do? Oh, that's the edge of its mouth I turned up so it was smiling. And I'm messing around like that with my monster. And after a while, only about 5 or 10 minutes, I was laughing because that monster was so ridiculous. I totally humiliated that monster, never came back again. So that's one way. You play around with whatever you're giving attention to, and you can actually mess around with it. And that means what was scary becomes really nice. So you can let it go. Or you should examine the danger in those unwholesome motives. Yeah, you can start thinking about that person in your cottage who's always been putting the shower on at 2 o'clock in the morning, who's been making the tea just when you get to bed, and you're thinking, well, you know, I've got to keep the precepts now, but when on the way home, what can I do? I'm gonna ring the airport up and say that they've got a bomb in their teddy bear or something. So they'll be taken away from the line and examined and missed their flight. I'm going to give them a hard time. Or whatever. And so you start thinking of all that sort of stupid stuff. And then you say, oh my goodness, that's dangerous. What am I wasting my time for? It doesn't hurt them, but it certainly hurts me. So danger in things. Yeah, you know, you're human beings. You have hormones. You may be married. Everyone has to practice restraint, you know, with their lust. So if you're single or if you're married, you still see someone you really like. Wow, he's hot. But then what do? You're married. You're a monk. A nun. If you go there, it just gets really worse. So you just make trouble for yourself. So you see the danger in those unwholesome motives. It's just not worth it. Now, I know that, I tell this to monks, but maybe you as well. You know, sometimes people have fantasies about winning the lottery or getting some great inheritance, and then you get a nice place and a beautiful partner, great job, and you justify it by saying, yeah, and I can use all that money to sort of make merit and build monasteries and build a nunnery for Venerable Chanda, and you fantasize and dreams. You can go on a long time like that, but what I used to do is say, then what? Then what? Then what? Then what? Then what? I'd actually fast forward the fantasy as fast as I could. And in the end, it was so what? So, examine the danger in those things. Just go to its ending, and it's so what? And that means that, you know, it's not just, you don't stop the fantasies when Prince Charming and Cinderella walk off into the sunset. Sort of, you always say, then what? Then they've got to get a place to live and pay rent. And then they've got neighbours. And they've got all sorts of stuff. So it's dangerous. Oh, if that doesn't work, you just ignore those unwholesome motives. Do not give attention to them. And that's actually where that simile of the screen came in. You've got a screen, the good stuff you keep in the centre, then the problem stuff. You may hear somebody snoring during the meditation. And you just don't focus on that. You just put that onto the side at the center. It's on the meditation object. Eventually that just disappears. Because if you don't give them attention, they just disappear. So if you ignore them, they go. Or should... Now, this is a... I love this one. You should give attention to stilling the causes of those motives. The causes, where do they come from? You know, you have like lust, or you have anger, or you have, you know, just any other sort of guilt or fear. Why? And that's why a lot of times, and the Buddha said this, that you run away because it's your escape route from moments of suffering. This moment now is not nice, you're suffering. So just go off into a fantasy. Go and stuff yourself with food from the refrigerator. Just go and watch a movie. Anything to get away from this moment, because it's a response, it's ill will. For not being happy with what you have. So stilling the causes, be content. Bit of wisdom, you know, what do you need? This is good enough. So that means that when you see the causes of these unwholesome things which come up, then you say, I can stop the causes, and then the effect disappears. Restlessness, waves on the lake, that is overcome when you stop the wind of wanting. Find out what causes it. The last one is just really, if you've got nothing else to do and you're about to do something really bad, which is going to cause you a lot of trouble, you should clench your teeth with your tongue pressed against the roof of your mouth and beat down, constrain and crush any such afflicting unwholesome motives. That's only to get rid of the bad stuff. If you think, I've had enough with Ajahn Brahm's bad jokes, how many times do I have to hear this? And you have this plan to actually go to my hut in the middle of the night with a big axe and just check, or chainsaw, and check if Ajahn Brahm really can practice this, if your limbs are cut off with a chainsaw, that, you know, you can have loving kindness. I'm going to check him out, see if he really is an arahant. Cut his head off and just see what he says. So if you have those sorts of ideas, please clench your teeth with your tongue pressed against the roof of your mouth. Beat down, constrain and crush any such afflicting, unwholesome motives, okay? That's... I must admit, such force, yeah. I think it's you use such force just for the time being, because it doesn't really solve the problem. It just delays you doing something really, really bad. So it's just like the Buddha did say that if this was to King Payasi, if you've got a Prince Payasi, yeah. Anyway, if your kid has got a fishbone stuck down his throat, you'd put your hand down there, and even the kid was screaming and think you were torturing it, just to get that fishbone out, just to save the kid's life. So it really is just the last resort. Just really, you have no other options, and not doing anything will be worse. But I've never seen a case of that. So anyway, so it could have been added afterwards, because it's number 5, but when people say things have been added, you have to have some pretty good evidence, not just because you don't think it fits. The endeavor to develop. What is the endeavor to develop? Here you develop, you know, good things. You develop mindfulness, exploring the Dhamma. Now, some people say investigating the Dhamma, thinking about the Dhamma. But I'm actually very happy with that translation, exploring the Dhamma. Because if you go and explore, say, the grounds of this jhana grove, you don't think about it. You just go and look here and look there with a nice mind, inquisitive, but not thinking. You explore it. Or the enlightenment factor of energy, rapture, tranquility. Remember happiness, stillness. Stillness is samadhi, and equanimity. Every one of which is based on seclusion, physical and mental, fading away, cessation, maturing and release. That's called the effort to develop. We're going to go on these 7 enlightenment factors later on. And the endeavor to maintain, what is the endeavor to maintain? Here you keep in mind an arisen meditation object that generates stillness, such as recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha, or like I said, your really good deeds, a skeleton, or a loving kindness, or the breath, or a nimitta. This is what I was talking about this morning. If you keep an arisen meditation object that generates stillness, inspiration, happiness, then that just gives you a very, very good stillness. It's the happiness develops the stillness. The skeleton is a weird one because we're told to do that as young monks and nuns simply because as young monks or young nuns you have lots of hormones, just lust. So when you see somebody who is also really young and attractive, you just look at them as a skeleton, as a bunch of bones. And because, you know, monks and nuns do that, you know, sometimes generates stillness, a skeleton. It's weird, but if you focus, most times it's actually focusing on a skull. People focus on a skull, it's actually quite interesting, you can grab the mind, and after a while the skull starts to fluoresce, it gets really bright and beautiful, and that becomes a nimitta. I know many monks who use a skull, and from there they actually get a nimitta. This is called the endeavour to maintain. Restraining, abandoning, developing, maintaining, these four endeavours were taught by the Buddha. By these means, a diligent meditator in this very life can attain the destruction of suffering. Now, I just pause that for a moment because, well, that's all you need to do. You don't need to do mindfulness, you don't need to do meditation, just do restraining, abandoning, developing, maintaining. Because it's just the idiom there, the Buddha says any one of these is almost like a complete path in itself, because in order to restrain, abandon, develop and maintain, you do need all these other parts of the path. Anyway, we can go up or scroll to right mindfulness. This is the Satipatthanas. And right mindfulness is no better translation than I know for mindfulness. So the four focuses of mindfulness, instead of calling the four foundations, because when you look at these four, it's what you focus your mindfulness on the body, on experience, on the citta, the mind, or on these mind objects. So it's really just where you put your mindfulness. You can be mindful of anything. But this is putting the mindfulness on four interesting things. And the reason why those four is because for a lot of people, especially those first three, that's where they tend to feel they exist. The body, or the experience, this is the real me, I'm happy today. And when I'm miserable, that's not the real me. So experience I identify with, body I identify with, the mind I identify with. That's why you focus on these things. And the last one is actually just what to get rid of, what to let go of, the five hindrances, and what to establish, the seven enlightenment factors. But that comes later. So the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only. But sometimes people, and really there's no reason to do this, I would call it even mischievous, because the word ekayana will never ever mean the only path. Can't mean that at all. That is a very, very bad translation of the Pali. The commentaries don't say that. Visuddhimagga doesn't say that. And also next sutta after the Satipatthana Sutta, there it says very clearly that ekayana means just one direction leading, one way street. Not the only way, but a one direction only. To the purification of beings, to go beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana. What are the four? So, the summary, 1, 2, 3, 4. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. Now, you may know that in each of these ones, it's aware of the body, experience, the mind, and the mind objects. Sometimes the translation was having, something covetous and grief for the world. Having abandoned covetousness and grief for the world? Yeah, the old translation. And I thought, hang on, what is covetous? What does grief for the world mean? And then when you read it all in Pali, you find out that those Pali words are vinaya, which is actually restrained. It's not really abandoned, having restrained it. Because you only abandon those things when you become an anagami or arahat. But Lokeya Bija, as I read and read and read in Pali, you saw that was a synonym for the first hindrance. The first hindrance is usually Kama Chanda, maybe about 70% of the time, but 30% of the time it's called Lokeya Bija. And Domanasa is a synonym for the second hindrance in two places. So these are synonyms, having abandoned the first hindrance and the second hindrance. And the commentary said, if you have the first two of a group, then you always have the whole lot. So having restrained the five hindrances would be the translation which even the commentaries would have given to this part of the Satipatthana. And it makes a lot of sense. You haven't abandoned them, you've weakened them, restrained them. And why? It's because you've had the right view, the I, and the no-self thing. You've had the right motivation, and from the motivation, what you actually do and say, and then the sort of the restraint of the right endeavors. That's their purpose, of the first six of the Eightfold Path, to restrain the five hindrances, to weaken them, because the five hindrances are what makes you not see what's happening. You don't see what's there, you see what you want to see. Or you can't see just what, you know, is just too abhorrent, which is too nasty to see. You've got aversion to it. So, having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. So, if you are driving me at 4 o'clock or just beforehand back to Bodhinyana Monastery for the Pawarana ceremony, you don't be mindful of your breath going in, breath going out. You be mindful of the road ahead, not going too fast, turning, not into the face of a moving car. You're mindful of the right thing. You know the purpose of why you're doing this. And mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of experience. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the mind. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing. Why are you watching the mind? And mindful. And having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of mind objects. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing. That's Sampajanya. And mindful. Okay. We come up to that when we do the four, because it's an interesting little point which some of the monks like Fenuanalio and Sujata and Bhamari have discovered. I'll just go ahead a little bit. They had a look at all the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, which you can find in many other different traditions. You know, in Sarvastivadins and some of the Mahayanans, and they found that some traditions there was only two parts of the four Satipatthana, just the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. That was the original Satipatthana of the four Satipatthana mind objects, and it makes so much sense. Those other objects were added in, and it's not wrong. But the simplicity of the original, the earliest version of the Satipatthana Sutta, only had two. The five hindrances, which you have to be aware of, because you learn them, their causes, so you can abandon them, and you learn, are really aware, that you are developing the seven enlightenment factors. Because that's our path. The path to abandon the five hindrances and develop the seven enlightenment factors. That's what meditation is supposed to do. That's what all the Eightfold Path is supposed to do. That's another path of becoming enlightened, and abandoning what goes in the way, the hindrances, the obstacles to enlightenment. So anyway, mindfulness of the body. How are you aware of the body? You go to a quiet, secluded place like Jhana Grove. Sit down comfortably and give priority to establishing mindfulness. So mind for you, breathe in, mind for you, breathe out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware that they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. Then you learn to experience the hold of the breath as you breathe in and out. Then you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. The first four. I did shorten that a lot because the original was when you breathe in a long breath, you know you're breathing in a long breath. When you breathe out a short breath, you know you're breathing in a short breath. When you breathe in a... And even I get sort of tongue-tied saying that all. So try and make it simple. So you breathe in and out, you know they're long. That's the first four. Just as a skilled painter is aware whether they are making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when the in-breath is long, you are aware that it is long, dot, dot, dot. Now, the original was a lathe worker. And I know what that means because we did build a lathe in our monastery 43 years ago, no electricity. We knew actually how it worked. And the Buddha stimuli makes sense to me because you have a little treadle and it has a rope and the spring was just a big bamboo stick. So when you push down on the treadle, the rope which was tied around the piece of wood would actually go down and then you'd release it and the bamboo would spring up again. And that's actually how you could pull it down and actually use it as a lathe. But I don't know anyone else who does that these days. But one thing which you all have done probably is painting. You know, painting a shed or painting a wall. So you know if it's a short brushstroke or a long brushstroke. So try to keep the essence of the similes, but make them more relevant. So, hang on, where's it gone? Where's my paintbrush gone? Okay, there we go. So, can you do a medium... A swipe stroke on that computer to get to the next page, please. In this way, you are aware of your own body, or you're aware of that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, or you're by aware of the nature of both your own and others' bodies. Some people think that some people are aliens, they're reptiles, they're not really the same, they're cyborgs. And we actually had this once. Not my retreat, but someone else was teaching a retreat here in China Grove, and they were doing the slow walking meditation. You know, just really slowly walking. You lift your leg up, and you move it forward, and it goes down. And a kid, you know, he shouldn't be coming in here, he shouldn't have visitors, but he came in with his parents, had a look around, really concerned, and demanded to see me afterwards. He said, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm! In your retreat center, there are zombies. There's zombies there. Because apparently that's what zombies do. Zombies walk very slowly. And for a 6 or 7 year old kid, someone doing the slow walking meditation, a zombie, they look actually pretty similar. So even the mice, it's really a bit cruel. But we call the slow walking meditation zombie meditation. You just do it. If it's slow, fine. If it's fast, fine. But don't force it. So, they're not zombies, they're the same measure as yours. And, although you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body. Now, the arising and passing away, it doesn't mean see the body go up and go down. It means what the causes are. It's the four nutriments. And those four nutriments are food, contact, sensory contact. That's one of the reasons why if someone is in hospital and they are in a coma, just talk to them, stroke them, because keeping that sensory contact going, if they lose all that contact, then actually that's a cause for the maintenance and continuance of the body is gone. And his will, as you always know, that people lose the will to live, then, or people have really, really strong will can keep themselves alive. Will is one of the causes, the nutriments of the body. And the last one is consciousness. So that's a cause. And you abide aware the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. Or you just abide contemplating the body's cause and nature of both arising and ceasing. Or else just mindful, it's just a body. Just a body. Just impermanent suffering. Not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. It's just body, that's all. is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. So you don't add on to the body something which is not there. It's mine, I can control it. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is one way that you are mindful of the body. Another way, the four postures. When walking, you are aware in the present, I am walking. When standing, sitting or lying down, you are aware in the present that I am lying down. Thus you maintain present moment awareness of however your body is disposed. It's just a very much a present moment awareness practice. So, you know, when you are sitting in meditation here, you're not on the aircraft flying back to Singapore. You are here. When you are walking, you are not checking your messages on your iPhone. You're actually here. You know you're walking. When you're sleeping, you know that this is sleep time. So you don't worry about all the problems you have for tomorrow. So that's what it really means. You're in here, in this moment. In that way, you're aware of your own body, or you're aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours. You abide aware of both your own and other bodies. Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments. Or you abide aware that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. Or you abide contemplating the body's cause or nature of both arising and ceasing. Or else mindful, it's just a body. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That's another way you are mindful of the body. Third, full comprehension of the purpose. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when looking ahead and looking away. When flexing and extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things. The original says when wearing your robe and carrying your bowl. But that's only monks who wear their robes and carry their bowls. It's not everybody, so wearing your clothes and carrying things. Why are you wearing your clothes? As a monk, it's not to become a supermodel who models the latest in robe wear. It's you wear your clothes just for the protecting your body, keeping it simple, and just maintaining some decency. And carrying things, you act in full comprehension of the purpose regarding eating, drinking, defecating, and urinating. What are you doing that for? Just to maintain your body. When walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, and keeping silent. Now, in the many of those translations, they say, being asleep and waking up. But it does not mean that. It means sleeping. And that is one of the reasons why I say, well, you should really practice to be mindful while you're asleep. And that causes a lot of tension in people. They think, oh, maybe it's lucid dreaming. And they try to capture themselves the last moment just before they fall asleep, and they find they never fall asleep. And they're so tense and doing something that they can't sleep well. It's not mindfulness in the sense of being aware, it's just knowing the purpose of these things. Why do you sleep? It's not to sleep there and fantasize. And while you're awake, it's not just, you know, just to waste time. It's learning how to develop the path. Why do you talk? Why do you keep silent? So that's why the noble silence is actually knowing when to talk and when to keep silent. In this way, you are aware of your own body, you are aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, or you abide aware of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, which is the four nutriments. Abide aware that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease, or you abide contemplating the body's cause and nature of both arising and ceasing. Or else mindfulness that it's just the body, impermanent, suffering and not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is another way you are mindful of the body. Now there's a lot of repetition here, but I did that on purpose because repetition sometimes has a purpose. It drums it into you. Just like the teacher would make me write lines I will not tell stupid jokes in class. 100 times. It didn't work, but anyway, I remembered it. The bodily parts. And they say, Aston, we don't repeat it anymore, it's enough. You review your body from head to toe, bounded by skin as made up of many kinds of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs. Now, the original goes through the whole list. And that's just ridiculous, because there's other things in there. If you've ever done anatomy, there's things missing, and there's things which you don't call them that anymore. And the most fascinating thing is, in the sutras, how many parts of the body are there? 31. And in the commentaries, they had 32. Because they missed out the brain. In the original Satipatthana, it was a no-brainer. They didn't have a brain. And it's only later on they discovered that you should have a brain, and I think that was typical. They had a heart in the original, in this time of the sutras, they didn't have a brain. And that's where all the thinking and stuff came. But anyway, there wasn't in there. It's just as though there were a full shopping bag with many kinds of groceries, such as bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables. And I did this for the Westerners, but they had like hill rice, brown rice, green rice. Yeah, okay, yeah, this is for the, yeah, that's a probably good point there, because, you know, there was, we had, well, and the durian as well, something. We had one of Ajahn Chah's most toughest of nuns came to stay with us for a range retreat. She was notoriously just very hard and very, very strict, and she would never actually get angry, except one day, one of the nuns staying with us, we didn't have much dana in those days, people coming. We had a lot of bread and a lot of baked beans. So she made beans on toast for everybody that day. And I really love that, it's great. But the nun said, you can't do this, you're killing the monks, you have to give them rice. And, you know, I don't want rice. No, you'll die without rice. What she meant was, I'll die without rice. And you get an understanding of, you know, Asian culture. You have to have rice. Otherwise, you know, there's nothing to eat. Or at least, you know, noodles or something there. So I can't agree with you. Okay, put rice in there. Bread, potatoes, rice, fruit and vegetables. So too, you view this same body as full of many parts. Thus, in this body there are hairs, bones, shit and urine. I put that in there just to, you know, wake people up at this time. Actually, you can't say that. Why not? That is another way you are mindful of the body. Elements. You view your body in the way of elements. In this body, the earth, water, fire, and the air element. That is another way you are mindful of the body. And I just made that really short because of theoretical physicists. The fire element and the air element are pretty much the same. One they call vibration, the other one they call heat. That's exactly the same. So, just whatever. That's fine enough. But if I wrote that, it would be you view your body by the way of fundamental particles. There's a hadron, there's a lepton, there's a quark. In that way, in other words, it's just made up of stuff. That is another way you're mindful of the body. The 9 charnel ground contemplations. And this, I don't know why it is, but some people really get into this. Apparently, in Madame Tussauds in London, the most popular of the big rooms is the House of Horrors or the Tortures or whatever. And even when I was staying in England once and some visiting monks came from Thailand and they, of course, you know, what to show them. So the guy who was the head of the monastery there said, let's show them Warwick Castle. A castle, because Thai monks haven't seen a castle before. So they took them in the castle. You know where they went to? The Chamber of Horrors, downstairs, with all torture equipment. It's crazy. Why do people like that stuff? But some people see this and think, oh yeah, this is really good stuff. It's weird, isn't it? If you go to Thai temples, they've got pictures of heaven and devas, but people don't really spend much time looking at that. All these people, you know, boiling oil and just these demons poking you and stuff. Kids love that. I don't know why. Anyway, you see a corpse thrown in the charnel ground, up to 3 days old, bloated, livered, and oozing matters. Then you reflect your own body as the same nature. It may become like that, and some bodies are already using. It is not exempt from that fate. Or you see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, being devoured by birds, animals, or maggots. Then you reflect your own body as the same nature. It may become like that, is not exempt from that fate. Or you see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews, disconnected bones scattered in all directions, bones bleached up white, the colour of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. Then you reflect your own body as the same nature, it may become like that, it is not exempt from that fate. But sometimes, if you do see, it's really rare to see a rotting corpse this time, but while I was in Thailand, we had the opportunity to go to autopsies to see what they were like. And in Sirirat Hospital, just over the river, I was told the best time to go is on a Monday morning. And just round the very back, because monks, we could go anywhere. Go to the place, the worst place of all, where they would have to do autopsies on people, corpses they dragged from the river. And that really was bloated. And it was really cool. Big, bloated body. Ugh. It didn't look like a human head. It looked like some monsters. And the doctor, he must have been the worst doctor in the hospital, punished for doing something that he had to go and do this job. And honestly, he had a big length of wood with a nail on the end. Not sterile, not high-tech at all. And because the first thing he did, we were watching, he had to puncture the corpse. And then as soon as he did that, all this stuff came out. And you can actually see yesterday's remains on the ceiling. And everybody just, including me, it's just a rotten smell, just really reeled back. And being a young man, have you done that yet? Ah, you're a namby-pamby, you must go there, that's the real thing. Really stupid, crazy monks. But it's very hard to see an autopsy. There was Bhante Gunaratne. I like telling a few stories. Bhante Gunaratne, he was talking about this part of the Satipatthana. And so, some of his students thought, let's go to the local hospital, you know, to the pathology department, see if we can get into an autopsy. And they went there, a whole group of his students, and you know, they asked and begged, look, it's part of our religion, it's part of our practice, we just think, and they couldn't get permission at all. And just most of them went home, one stayed behind. And when he saw one of the morgue attendants come out, he said, look, can't I sort of, you know, just come in and have a look? And again, look, so I've got no time for you, I'm just so stressed out, I'm just going through a divorce. And the guy said, actually, I'm a lawyer. I can help you with the papers, the divorce papers, if you let me come in. And, you know, lawyers are really expensive in the United States. So the morgue attendant thought, this is a really good deal. So they went to have some lunch, and you know, the lawyer helped with all the divorce papers. And then afterwards, the attendant sneaked him into the autopsy rooms. He put on a little coat. And you know, he actually saw the autopsy, standing around there, keeping quiet. And then there's a lot of doctors in there because it was an Afro-American, and they said that they called him a piece of work because he'd been through so many operations. And they were trying to find out what actually killed him. And then finally one of the doctors saw, yeah, there, that's it, and gave it a Latin name. And lawyers are notorious for not being able to keep their mouth shut. So the lawyer blurted out, oh, that's cancer. And everyone else went quiet and looked at him. And he said, who are you? Are you meant to be here? Because that actually meant, it was a Latin word for medical malpractice. He said, I'm a lawyer. Get out of here quick. That's why they don't let people into autopsies. They get the mistakes. Anyway, that's a nice anecdote which General Bhante Gunaratne told me. So anyway, autopsies and stuff. In this way, you're aware of your own body, or you're aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, so you abide aware of both your own and others' bodies. Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments, so you abide aware that the bodies are the nature to cease when the four nutriments cease, or you abide contemplating the body's causal nature of both arising and ceasing, Oh, mine, it's just a body, that's all. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. Is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation, and you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is another way that you are mindful of the body. Now you get the benefits of mindfulness of the body. When mindfulness of the body has been repeatedly practiced and developed, these 10 benefits may be expected. You overcome delight and discontent, especially with the body. Yeah, you feel achy. Yeah, you feel full of energy. Yeah, it's just the body doing its thing. You overcome fear and dread, especially of like dying or getting sick. It's a fear which causes more sicknesses. You bear cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with flies, mosquitoes, ticks, wind, the sun, creeping things. You enjoy unwelcome words and irritant bodily feelings that are painful and menacing to life. Just the body's going to go one day. You experience now. You experience whenever needed without difficulty the 4 jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding in this very life. The reason that is because you know what the body is, you're not really concerned with it anymore. You can let it go. Why can't people let the body disappear? It's because they are still attached to it. They don't really know it yet. When you know what the body is, oh, it's just a vehicle. Just like your car, you may have come here in. You park the car in the car park, it's quite safe. You don't need to keep checking on it. You can walk away and leave it alone. Just like this body in meditation, you park it on your meditation seat, close the doors, put on the security, and you can just walk away into the deep meditations, knowing your body is safe. Be there for you when you come back. Or you wield the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, you become many. Having been many, you become one. You appear and vanish. You go unhindered through a wall or through a mountain or so through space. You know, I can walk through walls. I use the door, so. It's a wall. I walk through it. Okay. And all through a mountainous through space, you dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird. You wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. With clairaudience and divine ear, you hear sounds both heavenly and human, those that are far as well as near. You can read the minds of other persons, having compassed them with your own mind, especially whether their mind is affected by one of the 5 hindrances or whether it is experiencing jhana. You recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births. Oh, you know, they say 1 birth, 2 births, 10 births, 50 births, up to 100 births. We just say up to 100 births. Many eons are expanding universe, many eons of decaying universe. There I was so named. Of such a family, with such appearance, such was my food, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared in this other place. And there too I was so named, of such a family, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, you recollect many of your past lives. With clairvoyance, you see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. One understands how beings are reborn according to their actions. And by realizing for yourself with direct experience in this very life, you enter upon and abide in deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, you are an enlightened one. The reason I'm rushing that is because now I am going to vanish. I'm going to disappear. Having been one, I'm going to be none, because it's 4 o'clock and I've got to be involved in the other, I'll be in big trouble. Arising and passing away, I'm now going to rise up and pass. Sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Oops. Where'd that time go? We finish the other ones tomorrow. So tomorrow we're back to normal, 4 p.m. And also, I'm going to put some extra interview times for tomorrow to make up for today. And I'll be back this evening at 8 o'clock for the Q&A. So any questions on this, you can ask.